This is a republic if you can keep it. An inside look at Michigan and national politics with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
I'm Jeff Timmer. Welcome to the We Know Nothing edition of A Republic If You Can Keep It. We Know Nothing sums up the testimony so far from Don Jr. and Eric Trump in the New York civil trial over business fraud, a trial that could put the Trump Organization out of business. In the coming days, we'll likely hear more pleas of ignorance from one-time White House aide Ivanka Trump and her daddy as the former president testifies in court under oath for the first time. And it comes 1 year from Election Day 2024, 365 days after we set our clocks back over the weekend. America will have the chance to set our nation back generations if they return Donald Trump to the Oval Office.
I don't have quite a metaphor there, Jeff. This is Mark Brewer. In Michigan, more action in the legislature this past week on a huge number of Democratic legislative priorities, some of them even garnering the rarest of all achievements, bipartisan support on the list, ambitious laws to make Michigan a leader when it comes to clean energy in this country. Compromise legislation easing the red tape and the restrictions on seeking an abortion in the state. And also compromise legislation implementing last year's statewide vote demanding reform when it comes to disclosure of income and assets by our elected leaders. Also this week, growing talk that Pete Meyer will join the Republican race for the U.S. Senate, which is very bad news for Mike Rogers, even as the DeVos family dumps $46,000 into the Rogers campaign. The U.S. House tabled a resolution of censure targeting Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib. And in one of the most important stories of the week, the apparent end to the weeks-long UAW strike against the big three domestic automakers, with strong hints of unionization efforts at Tesla and other and foreign manufacturers yet to come. Later in the podcast, we'll be joined by Senate Majority Floor Leader Sam Singh, who's deeply involved in just about every issue, key issue, facing lawmakers. But let's begin this week with deepening concerns about the impact of a foreign war on politics in Michigan, the battle between Israel and Hamas. Michigan is home to one of the largest Arab-American populations in the United States, and that sets as many concerned over how the Biden administration policies toward Palestinians in Gaza has the potential to erode his margins in this critical swing state. So, Chip, I'm going to turn to you. With the Lincoln Project and all the work you've done over the years, you have really studied very intensively at a micro level of the Michigan electorate. So I want to hear your take on what you think the impact is of the unfortunate war in the Middle East, in Israel and Hamas, on our own domestic politics here in Michigan.
Yeah, and let me just preface this by saying I have no intention to get into the thousand-year-old battle between since 600 or so, the battle between Christianity and Jews and the Islam religion that's been taking place in the Middle East. I want to focus on the politics of this. And I know that was the basis of your question here. And when it comes to elections, the elections are math. If a constituency, a coalition that delivered a win for Joe Biden in 2020 came from a margin out of Arab voter strongholds in Michigan, like Dearborn and Hamtramck, and it was X amount plus 80% or whatever margin for Biden in 2020. If that is diminished in 2024 because of his strong anti-terrorism, anti-Hamas stance, pro-Israel, that has taken on political life beyond the war in the Middle East here in this context. Does this potentially make Michigan a much more vulnerable state for Joe Biden in his anticipated battle next year with Donald Trump? And I guess the definitive answer to that is maybe. It's hard to say, because you can look at the very wide margin that that Joe Biden beat Donald Trump among Michigan Arab American voters in 2020. It was nearly 80% margin favoring Joe Biden. However, fast forward to 2022 and Gretchen Whitmer's landslide reelection, much wider than Joe Biden's, much wider than even her landslide of 2018. her margin in Dearborn and Detroit was still considerable, but it was roughly half that of what Joe Biden won those areas by in 2020, even as she was expanding her statewide vote total. So that tells me that she lost some support. The Democrats lost some support. And if people remember, there was a targeted Republican effort, Tudor Dixon and others in Dearborn and in Hamtramck on LGBT, school, transgender issues, books in schools, that they took their culture war into these areas and really used it as a wedge. And by looking at the results, used it somewhat effectively in those areas. They diminished the Democratic margins. However, when you look at looking at it in a micro context, you could say that hurt the Democrats in those areas. But overall, the Democrats, Whitmer performed better overall compared to Joe Biden. So I think it's not to say that this issue can't be harmful to Biden, especially if he somehow were to shift his support and also somewhere along the way lose some Jewish support in the process. But it's not just Arab and Jewish support that's at work here. This is, how does this affect those swing voters across the state who do see this as Biden siding with the right policy? The right policy makes the right politics. That's, I guess, the long-winded way of saying, I don't know exactly how this is going to play out next year, but I think if the president continues to exercise the policy he's started off with in this last month since Hamas's awful attack on Israeli civilians, if he sticks to that effort, I think it's going to be a political winner for him too when it comes to how it intersects with his reelection chances.
Yeah, no, I think that's good analysis, Jim. I just want to, you know, add a few things to it. As you pointed out, Trump and the Republicans were already playing to the Muslim community, particularly in Hamtramck and Dearborn, even before this started. But I think one of the things Biden's going to have to do is remind those communities and others that how anti-Muslim Trump was and how he promises, again, he has already said on the campaign trail, I hadn't got enough coverage, I'm going to reinstate the ban on Muslims. Those of us who remember 2017, there were near riots at airports around the country because of that terrible ban. And that was just the beginning. And I think it's going to be important here for the campaign, the Democratic Party, Biden and so forth, to make sure people are aware of Trump is no friend of the Muslim community, either in Michigan or nationally. And he's going to do exactly the same thing or worse that he did last time. I think another aspect of this that interests me here, Jeff, is it's not just the optics. This could be a factor down ballot. There's already talk of possibly in the Democratic side running primary against Congresswoman Tlaib. There are other Arab American and Muslim lawmakers who could face primary challenges as well. It may even, I think, stir up some animosity against some of our Jewish lawmakers as well. So it's not just the top of the ticket, but I think we could see this play out. And again, I'm with you. We don't know what's going to be the fact a year from now in terms of how this all plays out. But it certainly adds a complicating factor that all these campaigns are going to have to take into account as they go forward. I've personally been pleased to see. I agree with you. I think Biden is doing the right thing policy-wise, but he's also been very good about, look, this was a terrible thing that Hamas did. They need to be eradicated, but we've also got to take into account the humanitarian concerns of the population of Gaza and otherwise. And from all reports, they seem to be working, he and the Secretary of State and others seem to be working very hard on that. They're not doing it for political reasons. They're doing it for the right reasons. But as you and I both know, usually good policy is good politics. And I think that, and I hope, obviously, as a Democrat, that is exactly what happens here.
Let's talk a little bit about the continuing evolution of next year's U.S. Senate race in Michigan, which is open for this particular seat for the first time in a very long time. Debbie Stabenow is retiring, as our listeners know. Alyssa Slotkin, the Democratic congresswoman from mid-Michigan, has been running for the seat for nearly the entire year. Republicans have been slow to mount their challenges, but now since Labor Day, Mike Rogers, the former congressman, jumped into the race, failed gubernatorial candidate, the former Detroit police chief, James Craig, has jumped into the race. And we've talked about the dynamics there and the Trump versus the Trump light dynamics between Rogers and Craig. But now, former Republican Congressman Pete Meyer from Grand Rapids, who served one term, lost his Republican primary after voting to impeach Donald Trump, one of the few Republicans who did, has announced this week, or has leaked his intention to form a committee and run for the U.S. Senate. How do you see this affecting the overall trajectory of the race and how the race is viewed within the national chessboard that this battle will take place in?
Yeah, I'll add another wrinkle here. Just today, our listeners know that I'm the lawyer for the lawsuit here in Michigan to get Trump off the ballot. Pete Meyer filed a brief in that case today saying that Trump should remain on the ballot. So I don't know if this is Pete Meyer just trying to placate to Trump and try to, you know, make good for what we all remember was his vote for impeachment, which is what put him on the outs with Trump and the MAGA folks. I don't know, Jeff, I think we talked a little bit about this before. I think there's a relatively small segment of the Republican primary electorate in the state at this point that would back either a Meyer or a Rogers, and they're just going to divide the vote. We've already got the DeVos's heavily in Rogers' corner. I'm sure he'll be able to raise other money as well. Now, obviously, Meyer brings his own resources to the race. And again, it just seems to me to help James Craig if he can ever get his act together. But we also saw continuing turmoil in his campaign as he loses two more top staffers, including his campaign manager, who was quite harsh as he walked out the door. It seems to me Craig is his own worst enemy, and this race is his to lose, particularly with Meyer getting in the race now. But Lord knows he could lose it, Jeff. But I think you have a different view.
When Mike Rogers jumped into the race, the National Senatorial Committee came out and endorsed him. Steve Daines, the senator from Montana, who's leading that. Mitch McConnell's Senate operation, his soft money operation, announced their intent to get behind Rogers. And then Rogers, I've talked about this before. I think it was a very curious timing of his announcement. He announced around Labor Day when there was roughly 30 days to go in the fundraising quarter, which to me signaled he was going to make a big splash when it came to those numbers that were reported in mid-October. But he didn't. I think that number had to be far in excess of $1 million collected in that 30 days to show that he had some mojo going on. And he raised what might be a respectable amount in, if it was 2 years before the primary in an open seat race, but it was $750,000 or $800,000. It's not chump change, but it certainly didn't wow the world. And it really makes me question why he didn't wait till October 1st to announce when he would have 3 full months to raise money and hit somewhere in the solid 7 figures and hit January in that first reporting with something that made people maybe say, wow. So he was really underwhelming. And it was underwhelming enough that Pete Meyer looked at it and said, oh, shit, I can scratch a check for 10 times that right now. And so I think Mike Rogers is the biggest loser in this. And the Republicans is that now they have what could be looked at as 3 credible challengers, right? But with those 3 credible challengers, I think they have a very, they're further away from winning the Senate seat than they were before any of those 3 entered the race. I think that I don't see Pete Meyer having any path to winning a primary. I just don't see it. And his entry, I think, kneecaps Mike Rogers' chances of winning and only helps James Craig, who I think already had a strategic advantage because of how closely he's tied himself to the MAGA wing of the party. He already had that advantage over Rogers. Now I think it expands his advantage over the, in a 3-way race or a 4-way. There's other minor candidates in the race who, I guess, Nikki Snyder and her crazy Moms for Liberty wing could catch some fire here with the right wing ecosystem. But in any case, I think that Alyssa Slotkin has to be looking at this and liking what she sees developing on the Republican side, because it's increased the chances that James Craig, who has been a total clown as a candidate in 2022 and hasn't exactly wowed the world here so far in 2024, or ahead of his 2024 campaign. So I think the big winner of all this Republican motion in the last 2 months has been Alyssa Slotkin.
Yeah, no, I agree. And let's close this piece with this. Despite my criticism of Craig and all these other problems, he is leading in the handful of polls that have been done in this race. And I expect the next one will just, like I said, show Rogers and Meyer dividing the opposition to him. But I want to get on to that. To the other, one of the other big stories of the week, which is it looks like it's ratification that the UAW just had a very successful, historic strike result against the big three automakers here, record contracts. It looks like the contracts are going to be covering in a variety of ways the battery plants that these companies are building. And it looks like this could be, these wins could be something that the UAW could leverage into organizing efforts. And before I turn to you, Jeff, I just want to say, and I think Biden comes out of this smelling like a rose. You and I both know he was hearing advice from both sides. Don't go to Michigan. Don't stand with the UAW. To his credit, he did. Showed up very publicly on a picket line while Trump swung off to a non-union, anti-union company and trashed the UAW. And I just think Trump looks bad and Biden comes out of this looking very good. But what's your take, Jeff?
Yeah, I think the, you know, watching, it's been astonishing to me how rapid the ramifications of the proposed settlements, the tentative agreements are that the UAW has reached with the big three American automakers, because there was a news already this week that this is going to increase wages at Toyota as they look to try to stave off unionization. And now this week, Sean Fain was making overtures and rattling sabers at Tesla. And so I think it's a very muscular position for the UAW in resurgence of labor's economic might, but also could be signaling return or increase of their political might, which has been on the wane over the last few decades. And the optics right now in, I think, a solid majority of voters, including many Republicans right now, is very sympathetic to what the UAW just won, how that impacts the economy, how that affects their lives. You don't, from your work in Michigan politics over the decades, as do I, that you don't get, there's fewer union households today than there were, say, a generation ago, but still you don't have to go too many degrees from any family before there's a connection to a labor union household. And within the family, friend, close group, we understand it's part of our lives. And I've had policy differences. I've had political differences over the years with some of the unions. But I think right now, as I stand back and watch this, the sympathy, this was a big public relations win as well as a big factual, contractual win for the UAW. And I think they're just beginning to flex what could be a renewed muscle on the political stage, not just in Michigan, but that could have ramifications across the country, certainly across the Midwest. And if they're successful in unionizing in some of these foreign manufacturer plants like Toyota or Honda or others.
Yeah, no, it's important that you mentioned, because to this day, candidates on both sides of the aisle, if they've got any connection, like I'm the son or a daughter of a auto worker on both sides out, people still mention that connection very much. James, I think Musk has got to be very careful here. He is the classic stereotype of the billionaire class that President Payne of the UAW has been talking about. And so he's a very juicy target, I think, for that kind of attack. I don't know if you saw today, I saw a story that the companies are not only agreed to this very good contract, they're now going to pay the strikers. So it will not come out of the UAW strike fund. They're going to pay these striking workers for the time they spent on the big line, which is just another extraordinary development. But I also like the politics of this, Jeff. I think it does help Biden and Democrats in Michigan, but also could be very helpful in Pennsylvania, where there are a lot of auto workers and others, blue collar workers in general. And Ohio's tough for Democrats at this point. But boy, this could be a real shot in the arm for the labor movement and the UAW in Ohio. There are organized plants down there, but there are unorganized plants as well. And they may well be some of the prime targets for some of this. Who knows? Indiana's out of our reach at this point, but there may be some organizing opportunities in Indiana as well. But yeah, this is a great sign. My hats off, President Fain and his team in terms of what they've done here. Obviously, again, we got to be careful here. They haven't been ratified yet, but these are terrific contracts by all reports, not just for the economic benefit of the members, but for the health of the union in the long term, making sure that giving them opportunities to organize these battery plants and to be able to take a huge win like this to non-union companies and say, see what the UAW can do for you. You need to join the union.
The latest on Michigan's legislature as the Senate's majority floor leader joins the conversation. After these messages on a republic, if you can keep it.
Epic MRA is pleased to sponsor this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and public policy issues.
Our clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, all levels of state and local government, and membership organizations. For the November 2022 election, Epic MRA published the most accurate final pre-election poll among several state and national polling firms.
Our polls most closely predicted the actual election results in races for governor, secretary of state, and attorney general, as well as the three ballot proposals.
Epic MRA is clearly the go-to polling firm in Michigan. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Ben Franklin may have invented the Franklin stove to stay warm, but we go Ben one better. We have the Ben Franklin hoodie, dedicated to Americans for sanity. But wait, there's more. Our merch store has coffee mugs for Democrats, uncrazy Republicans, and free-thinking independents, as well as t-shirts for the discerning democracy lover. Just click on the Merch Center link on our homepage, arepublicpodcast.com. Show your support for political sanity at the podcast merch store. It's your duty as an American.
Joining the discussion this week is the state Senate's majority floor leader, Sam Singh. As floor leader, Singh is the traffic cop for legislation in the Senate. He's also the lead sponsor of some of the most critical legislation facing the legislature this year.
Singh is an East Lansing Democrat and was the Democratic leader in the last of his three terms in the state house. He's also a former mayor of East Lansing.
Welcome, Majority Floor Leader Sam Singh. First, congratulations. You've been doing a fabulous job for the last 11 months. Our listeners can't see this, but Sam is smiling as we are talking to him. That's great to see. I got to ask right off the bat, one of your big projects, things you've been working on, is this energy package. Tell us where we are on that.
Yeah, it's been a great week. Senate Democrats introduced our climate package in April of this year. We spent the entire summer working with stakeholder groups, trying to refine that package. And now we're at the final stages of getting it all passed. Our first major bill of that package was a bill to get Michigan to 100% clean energy by 2040. It involves 60% renewable energy by 2035. And then from that point forward, you begin to take a look at things like nuclear energy and other activities to be able to make sure we get to a place where we can have reliability, cost effectiveness, but make sure that we are really changing the way we do energy. Our second bill in the package really takes a look at how we bring equity to the Public Service Commission as it looks at how it regulates our utilities, make sure that we are taking into account health impacts of their decisions, make sure that climate is at the forefront when they're making their decisions. And so pretty exciting legislation. The last piece of that was a bill to look at energy efficiency and how we can help our residents make their homes more energy efficient, their businesses more energy efficient. And obviously the best savings is, you know, not using that energy on those costs. And so it's an exciting package. It's going to be one of the top packages in the country for climate, and exciting that it's happening here in Michigan.
What do you think, Sam, the job impact is going to be here too? This is all great. We're Michigan. We're always concerned about jobs. kind of jobs we're going to see created by this package?
One of the great things that we've already seen is a lot of clean energy jobs have come to Michigan. We had a report come out over the summer that showed that Michigan actually is leading in green jobs here in the Midwest area. And as you begin to see this shift, you're going to see a lot more companies coming into Michigan, taking a look at putting rooftop solar onto small businesses, onto neighborhood homes, into community centers. But at the same time, you need to get these larger facilities, whether they're wind, solar, or storage, and you'll be seeing these larger companies as well. So I think there's an opportunity for the small entrepreneur to find some space here, but then ultimately the larger companies as well. And then when we look at energy efficiency, the programs that are going to get created out of that area, I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity to get workers out of our neighborhoods, get them trained on how they can get the skills to be able to do the work to making somebody's home weatherized, making sure that we're getting all the efficiency out of a home. And so we actually put some pieces in our legislation that would require our utilities as they're looking at hiring people for our energy efficiency jobs to go into the community and try to bring in people from our neighborhoods. And so we wanted to make sure we had equity at the center of these conversations. And so I think you'll see a spectrum of jobs created here, whether it's for people who are entering into this type of field to people who've been around and businesses who've been around for a while. At the same time, we created a bill, a Senate Bill 519. It's creating a just transition office within state government. I was pleased that Jasper Bartis, a good first term state rep out of Genesee County, worked with me to help implement this. And now for the first time in Michigan, we will have within the Department of Labor and Economic Opportunity an office that is focused on working with industry and workers to see what changes are going to be happening in their area. So we've asked them to focus in the first year on the energy sector, as well as the automotive sector, and take a look at the changes, whether it's EVs of the automotive sector, or if it's the new solar jobs that might be coming into Michigan. What do we need to do to train our employees to be able to get those jobs? We have a lot of federal money that comes through the state of Michigan. Now, perhaps we could utilize that in a proactive way, make sure that workers are being ready for jobs of the future, but then also helping the businesses if they have to retool themselves as well. And so this is an exciting new part of state government that will be created next year. It's being modeled after programs that we've seen work in Colorado and Illinois. But our focus was, let's help our workers make sure that they handle this transition well and be able to make sure they get good paying jobs as the transition happens.
I want to get in the Wayback Machine and go back to when I was a Republican a dozen or so years ago. I've been working in policy and issue advocacy on clean energy, on wind and solar for a number of years. And I saw it back in the right around 2010, 2011. As an issue that was a political winner for Republicans back in that day. I was still advising Republicans and said, look, you need to get out. This shouldn't be a partisan issue. You should get out ahead. This is an economic issue. This is an environmental issue. This is a common sense. It can be a winning political issue. And here we are now, fast forward a dozen years later, and Republicans didn't listen to me. And I don't mind that now, because I think they're on the wrong side of both policy and politics. Their talking points are the same ones, that tired old ones that they were saying back then. Anybody who's been in Michigan knows that our costs have historically been high and our reliability has been suspect over time. This, by everything I see, this is going to improve cost to consumers and reliability. One, do you agree with that, that this is going to be an economic win for consumers as well as workers? But also, the politics of this just seems like the Republicans are fighting a war that was won amongst voters a dozen years ago, and they haven't got the memo yet.
Yeah, I will say, I definitely have heard from our district, and I have a fairly diverse district, right? The 28th state Senate seat has Clinton County, Shiawassee County, and about a third of Ingham County. And so I've got a pretty diverse constituency, but climate is an issue that's impacting of whether it's the farm land in the Clinton, Shiawassee County that are going through some extreme weather events. We're seeing a variety of other topic areas with flooding and so forth. So I do think everyone is taking a look at climate and taking it seriously, at least from a residential perspective. But I do agree with you. The cost is going to be an incredible factor. If you take a look at how much solar has come down in cost over the last 15 years, you take a look at how much storage technology is just changing in the last 5 years, those costs have come down considerably. So it's oftentimes the most efficient and cost-effective way of moving energy forward. So for example, just this last summer, DTE had their integrated resource planning settlement, which they said they were going to move up a closure of a coal plant by 3 years. And by closing that coal plant down 3 years earlier and then moving towards renewable, they're going to save their customers $100 million. Again, $100 million with just moving that plant closure by 3 years. And that's because they don't have to bring in the coal from out of state. They don't have this very large, costly plant to run. And now you have, obviously, a renewable energy source that's going to bring down the costs for all of their customers. And so there's some great opportunities once you see that type of transition. But then we're also in a unique period of time because of the Biden administration. I think everyone knows that whether it was part of the Infrastructure Act or the Inflation Reduction Act, there have been programs that have been put forward that will bring dollars and resources to at the state level and the community level for energy infrastructure. And that is going to be very helpful. So there are dollars available right now for our utilities to pull down. And what they can do is put carbon capture onto their natural gas plants that will reduce the carbon intensity. There are programs that the state has applied right now. I think they've got an application of close to $400 million that they're applying for that would bring in community solar and rooftop solar with the prime focus of being in low-income communities. And so as we have all these federal dollars here at the for this only short period of time, the fact that we're passing legislation and those are all going to line up is going to bring billions of dollars to the state of Michigan. It's also going to make the transition much more cost effective.
If I can, to follow up on Jeff's point, it sounded to me as I was watching and listening from the outside, but you were there, you've been in the middle of all this action, that the Republican talking points were just basically echoing what Trump has been saying, like when he came in a few weeks ago and said, oh, EVs are going to destroy the auto industry. We've seen what the UAW has now done. They're making sure their members are in those plants representing them. Is that what you were hearing from the Republicans during the debate?
The debate that was on the House floor, obviously I'm a senator, but I was watching the House floor this week. You could have taken the same conversations from 20 years ago and just brought them here. Like nothing has really changed in their rhetoric. And it was surprising because obviously the general public has come a long way. The whole economics of climate has gone in a very different way, but they're living in the past and they're using scare tactic as talking points versus actually talking about what their residents want, what the residents are demanding. And so I'm not surprised that they're living in the past, but at the same time, if they're going to want to survive as a, whether it's a party or if they ever want to find control of these chambers again, I think they're going to have to be able to take a real look at themselves and take, hey, science, technology has moved a long way, and your residents and your party, not maybe your party members, but the people who still identify as Republicans have come a long way on this issue, but the elected officials haven't.
Yeah, even I think, and again, you're the expert on this. From what I can tell, a lot of the business community was behind all of this. The traditional allies of the Republicans in this state, and now the Republican caucuses are even out of step with their traditional allies because businesses see the opportunity here, don't they?
Yeah, there's programs within our utilities, voluntary green programs that most of our Fortune 500 companies are voluntarily moving themselves towards that. And so once we get the utilities to begin to move in that direction, those big businesses are trying to find that opportunity because they know their customers want that. They know their board of directors want that. And yeah, the business community has come a long way on those issues as well. And I think when you take a look at what Democrats put forward, both in the Senate and the House, these were very pragmatic policies. They will have a significant impact on climate. They will definitely do all the things that we want them to do, but we did them in a way that took a look at Michigan and the unique natures of Michigan. Michigan is a cold state. We have some of these days in our winter that we need to make sure that we have the reliability of our grid, that we want to make sure that sometimes wind and solar can't keep up with the amount of intensity we need to keep our homes and our businesses going in some of our winter months. And so the policy we put forward were very pragmatic. And so it became really hard for the Republicans to attack it because we took into consideration some of the most key reliability factors. And so at the end, they just ended up having their rhetoric, but weren't able to attack any of these issues with actual policy statements.
If I can switch, because you're at the forefront of so much, one of your big projects has been upgrading Michigan's financial disclosure, taking us from last in the country and moving us up. And it seems like we made a lot of progress in the last couple of weeks on that front. Can you tell our listeners about what's going on with financial disclosure?
Yeah, as your listeners know, last year we had a ballot proposal that moved forward term limit changes. But within that, there was a constitutional requirement that the legislature institute a financial disclosure program. We've been working with the House and Senate together, taking a look at a variety of different options, as well as what other states do. As you mentioned, we're one of the last states to actually implement financial disclosure. It's us and the state of Idaho. And so we have introduced a set of bills in the Senate. We actually did this one in a bipartisan fashion with some of our Republican colleagues. And what we've done is we took the baseline of what was in the Constitution and we built on that. We are trying to go as far as we can. Myself and Senator Jeremy Moss, who are the chief advocates for this, we also know that we have to get something that can get passed in both chambers and then also get signed by the governor. And so we've been really focused on making sure that as whether someone's a candidate or a elected official, that any source of income is now will be disclosed. We want to ensure that assets are disclosed of those individuals. We want to make sure that we know where their spouse works at, what company they work for. They want to make sure that if they have multiple relationships with other business ventures, we know what those are. But at the same time, we're having some debate. Our governor and some of our colleagues have said our spouses sometimes don't sign up for these types of things. So we're trying to find out how far can we go on spousal disclosure. Senator Moss and myself are pushing as hard as we can. And every week we're making our bills a little bit stronger, moving us up that scale. But at the same time, we've got a wide agreement now by both sides of the Senate to, and somebody doesn't even fill out these forms. We saw like at the presidential level when President Trump would not do financial disclosure, release his tax forms. We now have, you will not be seated as a legislator if you don't turn in your financial disclosure. So we're putting some real penalties to this, but at the same time, we need to get something that will pass. So we're trying to find the right landing spot on a number of these things. But this is just the first step for us. Next week, Senator Moss has been working on creating legislation for FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, and putting the legislature as well as the governor's office under FOIA. We're one of, I think, the only state that doesn't have some level of FOIA on the legislature or the governor. And so we're going to fix that. The Senate has been typically the problem. The Senate Republican leaders for the last 8 years have refused to take a look at bipartisan legislation on FOIA that had been passed at least for the last 6 years. And now Leader Whitney Briggs, who's the head of the Senate, has clearly said, we will pass it first out of our chamber since the Senate's been the problem. And then we can get the House, which has had traditionally no problem passing it. My hope is in the first quarter of next year, we can get to Governor Whitmer, FOIA legislation, again, bringing some more sunlight to the activities that are happening in the city of Lansing.
I find it amusing how the Republicans spent 40 years fighting disclosure laws and FOIA reform have in the last 12 months since the Proposal 1 passed last fall become the most zealous of converts, acting like this is somehow a Democrat-created problem, that the fact that here we are 11 months into the Democrats' reign of control in the legislature and we don't have the financial disclosure law passed, shame on them. When they had decades to act and didn't. Now, that being said, one of the places, and I know this is a complicated issue and the perfect can't get in the way of the possible when it comes to passing legislation. But one area that we've seen so much abuse and criminality, quite honestly, is when it comes to some of these unreportable, undisclosable 501c4s, for example, like when it comes to Lee Chatfield and the investigations going on there. Rick Johnson, who's now going to be heading to a federal prison in payments going to his wife through a C4, the speculation that is still looming out there with ongoing active investigation related to C4's control by former Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky and Arlen Meekoff, Meekoff related to the marijuana and Rick Johnson issues that still are looming out there. Is this something, if it can't be addressed in part of the package this fall, is this something that you plan to look at and bring some sunlight into so that the abuses that we've seen won't happen again in the future?
I think that's one of the things we've been trying to, at least as we talk to our colleagues and the media and others, is that when you talk about some of these other areas, there's other acts that have to be opened. There's some of these are a little bit more complicated because it's not just state law that's involved. There's federal law that's involved. And so what we wanted to focus on, one, was the constitutional requirement to get this financial disclosure done. We're going to do that. We're going to do FOIA next. And then from there, there's two or three other topics that we want to look at reform. So one of them is going to be the lobbying act. There's a lot of things that lobbyists in Michigan don't have to disclose, or there is not as clear of some of the definitions that other states have. And so we want to look at that. And then in the space of campaign finance, I think we want to take a look at a variety of topics, but 501c4s is one of those pieces, that at least around the activity of travel. That's something that we've been hearing a lot of consensus, is that there are a lot of legislative conferences that people can go to and so forth. And there's always been question about how do people fund some of that travel? Some people do it personally, but some of them do it through other types of accounts. And we want to ensure that we are doing that appropriately as well. And so that will be another part of the conversation that we have going into 2024. But some of these things, as I mentioned, are a little bit more difficult to figure out what the right answer is, because when you look at 501c4s, those are really creatures of the IRS tax code. And so there are some things that you can require in Michigan, but a lot of things are done at the federal level. And so I think we're going to examine how we can bring some more sunlight into those areas. But one of the things we have been doing is closely watching those three or four cases that you mentioned of Republican leaders over the last decade or so, and things that they have done. And we're going to try to close every single one of those loopholes that they've used to do criminal activity. You talked about how some people have been very loud over the last couple of months, saying, like, why haven't you finished the financial disclosure after their leadership that they served under stopped all that policy? But I do believe one of the reasons why you're hearing some of that is because they're trying to drown out what's happening with the Lee Chatfield case, the Rick Johnson case. And there's clearly trying to circumvent the conversation and trying to confuse the voter, the average citizen. But we're going to stay focused as Senate Democrats, working with our House Democratic colleagues. We're going to do each one of these in a very thoughtful fashion. Financial disclosure first, FOIA second. Then we'll take a look at the lobbying act, and then we'll go from there for campaign finance and other types of disclosures. But we will continue that work going into next year.
That's great to hear. Now we've opened that door, Senator. I'm going to ask you, can you give us a preview of what else might be on the agenda, either for the rest of this year, depending on what happens, or into early next year? What are you looking at, if you can tell us?
Yeah, the governor earlier and at the end of August talked about some of her priorities. They were priorities that were shared by Senate Majority Leader Briggs and Speaker Joe Tate. But one of those is the prescription drug board. There is legislation that the Senate passed about 3 weeks ago now that is sitting in the House, that we're hoping that the House will take action hopefully next week. Senator Jeff Irwin got through in a bipartisan way the removing of the liability shield that the drug manufacturers got for themselves. They have immunity from lawsuits from citizens, the only state in the entire country that the pharmaceutical companies got that type of protection. And our citizens at times have lost out on being able to hold those pharmaceutical companies accountable. Like I said, I think we had close to 8 Republicans joining with us to finally say, hey, enough is enough here. And so that's sitting over in the House. My hope is that my House colleagues will see that as something that needs to happen. But we do take a look at the pharmaceutical industry, the costs that have been being driven up by that industry, the fact that you're seeing every once in a while, there's a drug here, and then 1 month later, it's 1,000% more in cost. Having that drug price affordability board will actually be able to help Michigan bring down costs, but also hold the pharmaceutical companies accountable. And my hope is that is something that we can get done here in this short period of time. We wanted to also make sure that the Reproductive Health Act and all the elements of that, we passed a set of bills earlier in October, early part of October there. House has just sent us some, and so we're trying to clean some of those. We want to make sure that we're doing things that our citizens are expecting of us. And so some of these items, whether it's cleaning up laws that Republicans have put on to put restrictions on a woman's right to choose, or taking a look at items around pharmaceuticals, those are some really key priorities that we want to address right now. And if it needs some of that needs to go in the first quarter next year, we'll take our time to do that as well.
Senate Majority Floor Leader Sam Singh, again, congratulations. I don't know if there's ever been any Senate Majority Floor Leader that has accomplished as much as you have in the last 11 months, working with your colleagues in both houses, obviously. But it's been a remarkable record that people are still digesting.
This is just a proud moment for a lot of us as we've been taking a lot and reflecting as we get close to the Thanksgiving holiday about how much work has actually got done. I'm proud to be serving with the Senate Majority Leader Whitney Brinks, who a really solid leadership team that we have put here together in the Senate. We have wanted to have a very specific focus, and we did a great budget that was focused on people. We made sure that we did things focused on labor rights, on women's rights, on civil rights. And so all of those pieces are going to be things that we will continue to move into next year. But I think when everyone looks at what has gotten accomplished in 2023, it'll show that it was one of the most ambitious first year of a caucus majority shift, maybe in the last 50 years. And so we're really proud of our record, and we'll continue working hard till the end of our session this year.
Sam Singh, thank you so much for joining A Republic If You Can Keep It.
Thank you.
Before we go, news from our merch store. As you probably know, Donald Trump has been marketing all sorts of stuff featuring his Atlanta mugshot with the caption, "Never Surrender," which is ironic since the photo was taken after he surrendered to be booked by the sheriff. Our response? The Tribute to 91 Felonies mugshot mug. Same photo, new caption. I surrendered. Get it now? Just click on the merch store button on our website, arepublicpodcast.com.
And that's a wrap for this week. Our great thanks to Floor Leader Sam Singh for providing a comprehensive update on what's happening in the legislature.
And we thank you for giving us a few minutes of your day. If the Republic is still standing, we'll return next week.
A Republic If You Can Keep It with Mark Brewer and Jeff Kimmer is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.